Simon, thank you. Denny, thank you. This is Alan Beller. I'm the chair of the IFRS Foundation Trustees Due Process Oversight Committee. This is a public meeting of the committee on June 10th, 2020. All members are present, and there are no apologies. The meeting is quorate, and I would like to note that we have a new member of the committee who has joined us for this call, Alexandro Bordeaux. And welcome, Alexandro. And we will now move on to the public session. Richard, is this for you? I can note for the record that we did meet the commission. The committee most recently met in public session on April 16 to recommend to the trustees a shortened comment period for amendments to IAS 16. Comment period was recommended at 14 days. A 14-day period was approved by the board, by the trustees at its meeting on April 17. And the proposal went out with that comment period, and the board has now acted on the final proposal on IAS 16 so that revised standard has been issued. I would also note for the public session just that there's a short private session that will occur at the end of this, which is by way of recap. I now want to move on in the public session to the technical activities of the board and the IFRIC. And Henry Reese, I will ask you to take that on.
Thank you very much, Alan. So, committee members, this is Agenda Reference 1B. This is our regular paper providing an overview of the board and the interpretation committee's technical activities, covering on this occasion, obviously, since all activities since you met in February. There is no specific ask of you coming out of this paper today. And for many of the projects, I don't intend to say anything. I'm just going to pick on one or two highlights before opening up for any comments or questions committee members have. First of all, after highlighting the due process document published in the period since February on pages 3 to 6, which include the goodwill and impairment discussion paper that we've spoken about on previous occasions in March. In paragraph 10, I just thought it would be helpful in this paper to first of all just summarize all of our technical activities and the impact on our work plan arising from the COVID-19 pandemic. Now, as you know from your April meeting when we updated you on matters, we have been actively monitoring developments in the marketplace and then acting when we think we can usefully provide help to our stakeholders. And this has included providing some educational materials on a timely basis on the new credit impairment model in IFRS 9 and also on the new LISA standard. And those are mentioned in paragraph 11 of the paper. And we've also undertaken two pieces of standard setting. The first to mention is the one that Alan just referenced in his opening remarks. So this is in paragraph 13. It's the relief for lessees when accounting for rent concessions. I think we've reported most of the information that's in this paper to you previously. We discussed the project, obviously, at the April meeting when we considered the short and comment period as well. But I just included it all for completeness. And obviously, you can see here that the amendment was issued at the end of May as planned. So just, I think, worthy of note that with the benefit of that very short comment period, we managed to complete this project in about 7 weeks, but still had full due process and also some important outreach with some investors. I think also just it's worth noting on this one, I've highlighted in paragraph 16, that although the feedback that we got on the exposure draft was very supportive of providing lessees with relief, we did get a fair amount of comment requesting similar relief for lessors. And paragraph 16 just sort of summarizes why the board decided that standard setting wasn't justified in this situation. But I think the due process angle to highlight is effectively all of that feedback, despite the timeline we were working on, was very carefully analyzed in a separate paper that the board considered when it was considering the feedback on the lessee amendment as well. The other piece of standard setting arising from the pandemic is covered in paragraph 20. This is the deferral of the effective date of some recent amendments to IS1 dealing with classification of liabilities. Again, this project was discussed at your April meeting. I just wanted to highlight it this afternoon, just to highlight the project is proceeding as planned. The shortened comment letter period closed last week, and the board will be considering the feedback at the meeting this month. And so if they confirm the deferral in the light of the feedback, they will be issuing the amendment probably in July. I think the other matter just to highlight in this first section dealing with the sort of impact of the pandemic is the effect on our timelines. And I've summarized this from paragraph 22 in the paper, and the adjusted timelines are obviously also reflected in the changes to the work plan that you see highlighted in Appendix A of this paper. And of course, as we've explained at the previous meetings, whilst we ourselves have been able to adapt and continue working in a virtual fashion, we need to be mindful, obviously, that the pandemic has been very disruptive to many of our stakeholders. And of course, we rely on our stakeholders to provide us with valuable feedback on our consultations. So given this, we've extended the length of some of the ongoing consultations, as well as rescheduling when we will be issuing some of the forthcoming major consultation documents. Moving on from the impacts or the direct impacts of the pandemic on our work, there were just a couple of projects I wanted to highlight to you. The first is from paragraph 26 on this paper, which is the project on amending the new insurance contract standard, IFRS 17. Since we met in February, we've been continuing to work very intensely on this project. The project is all about making some very targeted amendments to the new standard to help with its implementation, but doing so in a way that doesn't unduly disrupt implementation or weaken the standard or the improvements that it brings about. And in fact, at the time of this meeting, the board has actually just balloted the amendments, and we're now moving into the final production process with the aim of issuing the amendments as planned towards the end of the month. And we've updated you on progress at each of your meetings about this project. And in this report, we just highlighted the last of the seven topics that the board considered in the period. I think just two of these topics are worthy of note. So firstly, the board decided to defer the effective date of IFRS 17 to 2023. So that's 2 years later than its original effective date and a year longer than we proposed as a deferral in the exposure draft last year. And in doing this, I think the board was being just responsive to the concerns that it heard on the exposure draft. In particular, some of our stakeholders around the world were concerned that if the board deferred the effective date by only 1 year, given some of the delays and uncertainties surrounding endorsement processes, it was possible that we'd end up in a position whereby insurers around the world would be applying IFRS 17 for the first time in different years. And just given the extent of the changes that IFRS 17 brings about, the board thought it would be much more beneficial to have people applying IFRS 17 around the same time. So to help facilitate that, the board decided to allow more time and extend the deferral by another year so that jurisdictions have just got more time to adopt or endorse the amended IFRS 17 into their own particular jurisdictions. And then the other topic to note is the annual cohort requirement, which is covered in paragraph 31. This is particular requirement is in IFRS 17, and what it does is it ensures that contracts that are issued more than 12 months apart are not accounted for together. And if you didn't have this requirement, what would happen is you potentially would have open portfolios so that profits could be released from contracts that were terminated many years ago and losses on onerous contracts could be delayed. Now, for this topic, the board actually looked in detail at the concerns about this particular requirement whilst developing the exposure draft, but it decided not to propose any changes of the standard. But we did receive a lot of feedback in response to the exposure draft, mainly from European stakeholders. And so the staff did a lot of work analyzing further all of the concerns that were raised, ready for the board to consider the feedback in detail again in February. And after careful consideration, the board reaffirmed its conclusion not to make any change to the annual cohort requirement. And I've tried to capture the reason for that in paragraph 4, but ultimately it was because the board concluded that really there was this only very small population of contracts where there was really a question about the balance and costs, sorry, about the balance of costs and benefits of this requirement. But trying to sort of define a very small population for the purposes of trying to create a very targeted exemption from the annual cohort requirement just ran too great a risk of ultimately weakening IFRS 17 and losing critical information. Now, it is a very important decision. So given this, the basis for conclusions to the amendments will provide a very full explanation for the board's rationale about why it decided not to make any change to this requirement. And that will also be sort of summarized in a more accessible way in the feedback statement. But also, we didn't want to wait until those documents were out, and actually Hans himself has written an article, which we put on the website, which I think has been appreciated by many of our stakeholders. And it really walks people through this whole thing, and it explains why the requirement is important and why the board decided not to make any changes. So as I said, we are really at the very closing stages of this amendments project, and we are aiming to be publishing the final amendments towards the end of this month. The last topic I just briefly wanted to mention is the one that just follows, paragraph 41. It's the project on IBOR reform. As you know, this is another time-sensitive project, given the market reforms. And so this is one of the projects that, although we've delayed timelines on some of the other projects that I highlighted a moment ago, this is one where, you know, stakeholders don't want us to delay, and we're continuing to move forward as we originally planned. And that's what I just wanted to flag to the committee, is that this project is proceeding as planned. The ED was published in April with the shortened comment period that you approved in February, and the board will be considering the feedback this month with the aim of finalizing the amendments and issuing them in the third quarter. So, Alan, those were the particular comments I wanted to make on this paper, and obviously we can take any questions from committee members.
Terrific. Henry, thank you for that very complete and thoughtful presentation. Open the floor to the committee. Do we have any questions, comments on Henry's report or the document? Okay. I would...
Alan?
Yes?
Alan? It's Larry. Just a quick question.
Hi, Larry. Go ahead, please.
Henry, how does the cohort issue, is there a similar challenge, if you will, to the U.S. GAAP equivalent? Are they going through a similar challenge?
I'm not aware of a similar challenge there, and I'm sorry, Larry, I can't really sort of speak to the sort of how in this area our requirements sort of relate to the U.S. equivalent requirements. What I would say is of course, the U.S. made limited changes to their requirements for long-duration insurance contracts, as opposed to the approach we've taken, which was obviously introduce a new model to replace the existing requirements.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments?
It's Michelle here. Michelle Madelin here. Could I ask a question?
Please, go ahead, Michelle.
Thank you very much. This is really in relation to some of the activities that took place in relation to COVID-19 and the, you mentioned on one end the process that was followed for leasing and some of the, what you've been able to achieve in a very short time frame. And could you contrast that to the sort of discussion and engagement that took place around ECLs, around the IFRS 9, and which was largely dealt through direct engagement with regulators and other stakeholders. And my question really relates to due process. What is the dividing line between situations where, like here, we had to change a standard and ECLs where, there's been a request for comments, interpretation, and so on. So I don't know if you or Sue could provide some color on that.
It's Sue here. I can comment on that if you like, Henry.
Thank you.
So the short answer is that what we've tried to do, particularly from a timeliness perspective, is to provide as much assistance as we can in the first instance in the form of educational materials, which we use when we are really just pointing to existing requirements and providing additional help to confirm the correct application of the requirements. So if I look at expected credit losses and the discussions that we had, which you're right, were involved quite a lot of discussion with the regulators, but also ultimately involved us publishing materials on our website for everybody to use. What we did there was we were able to point to existing principles and requirements in IFRS 9 and to highlight particular things that were sort of relevant and pertinent to the current situation. So we felt that by emphasizing existing requirements, we could provide help and that was what the market really needed and seemed to be sufficient based on what we've heard so far. Similarly with IFRS 16 leases, what we did in the first instance was some of the questions that people had were relatively straightforward ones. So, for example, if all I did was to pay the same amount of my lease payments, but I don't make you pay them today, I'll let you wait a few months and maybe just pay interest, is that necessarily a complicated accounting thing or is that something simple? And we issued educational material where we could to answer those simple questions, which could be answered based on the existing requirements. But what people then raised with us was actually something where we couldn't just point to existing materials and explain their application to achieve the outcome that we felt was needed. So in particular with leasing, we concluded that people did have a good case for why quite a simple change to the standard could provide a lot of relief for people while still providing good information to investors. But we couldn't give them that help without actually going in and making amendments to the standard. So in that case, we thought that we could be more helpful if we actually went the extra step to change the requirements. So whereas with ECL, we didn't change the requirements, we just confirmed the application of the requirements. With the modifications we made to 16, we actually needed to change words in the standard. And as soon as we actually change words in the standard, that's when we need to go out and consult and sets off the very formal and extensive due process with external comments.
Okay, that's very clear. So thank you. And maybe could you comment on where does IFRIC stand in terms of due process, again, you know, against those different set of circumstances? Okay, and yeah, where eventually yep. this could, you know...
Yep. That's a good question. So the first thing to note is that we haven't had any questions come into the Interpretations Committee that are related to COVID-19 so far. But if a question did come in related to COVID-19 and it came into the Interpretations Committee, what we would then need to do in the first instance would be look at whether, in fact, we could answer the question based on the existing requirements in the standard. And if we reached a conclusion that it could be answered with the existing requirements of the standard, in the standards, then an agenda decision would be something that the Interpretation Committee could use, which again would be a form of educational material in the sense that it doesn't change. We can't change the requirements in the standard, but we can help people gain a better understanding of the existing requirements using an agenda decision. That's a more formal process because it is subject to comment, but it is where we're not actually changing requirements. It's rather helping explain existing requirements. If the Interpretations Committee got a question where they felt that there was actually something that couldn't be answered with the existing requirements, or where they thought there was a case to be made for a need to, for example, improve or provide assistance, then in that case they might recommend narrow standard setting, which would then send us down a path via the board, similar to what we saw with the amendments that we made recently to IFRS 16. And really the key difference is whether or not the question initially comes in with a formal request to the Interpretations Committee. That sort of determines in part whether we go with educational material or whether we go with an agenda decision. But an agenda decision is also not formally standard setting, but it does have the enhanced comment period and due process around it.
And could the IFRIC be ask a question from, you know, does the question needs to come from outside the organization, or could you, you know, in light of the question you get, go to IFRIC and say, you know, this is a question that needs your attention, basically, or is that?
Typically, it comes through a question that comes in through the Interpretations Committee, but it is not impossible for us to sort of suggest to the Interpretations Committee that something could be addressed. So in the past, I know a few years back we had a question on negative interest rates. That was actually something that the staff internally had been made aware of in the market that they decided was a good question for the Interpretation Committee to answer. So I think the short answer is, for example, if on ECL we felt that we should or needed to go even further than we did in the educational materials that we put out, we could have considered whether we should put something to the Interpretation Committee, which would have then resulted perhaps in a more lengthy document than what we put out, which was relatively short, and we were very careful to be very, very, very close to the exact words in the standard, to be very clean from a due process perspective. So it is an alternative that is available to us. What we do need to think about then is it does take longer to do, and I think one of the key things that people appreciated with the work that we did on ECL in particular with COVID-19 was the fact that, you know, within a week we were able to sort of work on that educational material and get it out very quickly for March period ends, which people appreciated. but we can look at these in the interpretation committee ourselves if we want to. Having said that, people do usually prefer, you know, being able to see that it was externally generated, but it is a tool that's in the toolbox.
Thank you.
Alan, you may be on mute.
I'm sorry. I am on mute. I'm sorry. Let me say, I'm going to make a comment about 16 and Henry's observations. We did, the trustees approved a 14-day comment period. So that's a very short comment period, notwithstanding the fact that it was a very short comment period. And partly because in addition to going out with a proposal, an exposure draft, we also, the staff and the board, engaged in a lot of kind of proactive outreach to let people know this was coming and to try to gather views, even in a short period like 14 days. The board received some very useful feedback. The lessee-lessor issue was a very important part of the feedback. I would direct the public, everyone, to the paper that was prepared by which the board discussed, considered, and then discussed whether or not amendments should be made to 16 that extended to lessors rather than lessees. The conclusion of that consideration and discussion was that it should not. My point in raising all of this is not to discuss the merits at all, which are none of my business, but rather to point out that the board did a very good job, even with that shortened comment period, in hewing to the spirit of what we try to do with due process. And the other point I would make, which I think may be even more important, is, well, why do a 14-day comment period? Why not just dispense with the comment period altogether if you're going to go that fastly, that quickly? And the answer is what we just saw. Any comment period, even a 14-day one, gives the board an opportunity to get the feedback it needs to carry on its standard setting and its activities in an appropriate due process environment. Our constitutional documents prohibit us from engaging, the board from engaging in standard setting without any comment period, and I think we saw the reason why in capital letters in the case of 16, and I want to just call that out for the record. I think that does it for the technical activities, unless anyone has something. I'm going to turn this over to Richard and Sam and move the agenda towards the consideration of the final amendments to the due process handbook and their approval.
And again, I'm very happy to hand over to Sam who's done all the heavy lifting.
Thank you, Alan. Thanks, Richard. So I've just briefly introduced agenda paper 1C, and that is on the final amendments to the due process handbook, as Alan has mentioned. Agenda paper 1C acknowledges that we have circulated the draft of the final amendments to the members of the DPOC for comment. And I do thank the DPOC members for taking the time to go over the draft in detail and offer comments, which have been very helpful to improve the final drafting in the area. The draft of the handbook itself has been updated following the DPOC's decisions on how best to reflect the comments that we received on the exposure draft that was published last year. Those amendments have been made to improve the description of agenda decisions, to amend the due process relating to agenda decisions by asking board members whether they object to their publication, and to the final publication of an agenda decision, and also to improve the description of the role of effects analysis throughout the standard setting process. So as agenda paper 1C, a brief paper that it is, explains, we'd just like to use this opportunity to allow the DPSC to raise any substantive points that they may have, and beyond this, as the paper lays out, to ask the DPOC if they agree, subject to any edits arising from the editorial review process, to publish the amended due process handbook. That's everything I wanted to raise, Alan, so happy to hand it over.
Sam, thank you very much, and thank you, Richard. I'd open the floor to the committee for any discussion, comments, questions, before what I will plan to do next is seek a motion for the approval of the final version of the due process handbook as discussed. So are there any final comments, final questions, observations?
Here's Alex speaking here. I made a comment in the other session. I think I don't need to repeat it here, okay? Or do I? Sorry for the...
I don't mind summarizing it. There will be, I think, a minor change to the introductory materials to clarify what is clearly the case, which is, or to make even clearer what is clearly the case, which is that our due process and our due process handbook extend not just to the board and standard setting, but to the activities of the interpretations committee. That is the case, and that will be clear. Michelle, that will be taken care of. Thank you. Yeah. Anything else? Hearing nothing. This is a big moment. Every 5 years we get to do this. Do I have a motion to approve the handbook?
You have that motion from Ross to start with.
Thank you, Ross. Do I have a second?
Guillermo, I second it.
Okay, Guillermo, thank you.
Yeah.
Any other discussion? Hearing none, let me call for a vote. Can I, everyone in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Okay, any opposed? More importantly, telephonically, if there are any opposed, please register your disapproval. Okay, hearing none, I take it that the handbook has been unanimously approved. Richard and Sam, I gather that means we will prepare a final feedback statement which covers the process that we have gone through and the feedback we've received, and we will move the handbook through the final editorial process and towards publication. I think that's a correct
indeed.
Summary. Yeah,
that's absolutely correct.
Thank
Colin.
You very much.
Now, yes, and I will also say a huge thank you to Sam, who has carried this project in addition to a lot of other things that he has had to deal with, and Richard and Henry and others who are not on the phone on the technical and trustee staff. I thank the members of the committee for their helping get this through. Thank Hans and Sue and the members of the board for their help. So in this public session, I want everyone to know that this has been a successful group collaboration and that we have now reached the end of it. So thank you. Richard, I guess we should, at least for the record, have we received any correspondence that needs to be considered by the committee?
No correspondence received to the committee, Anna.
Thank you. I think that unless there are any other comments by members of the committee, pause for a moment. I will close the public session.
Alan, it's Larry.
Hang on one moment, Jenny. Larry, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I think I would echo the... I would echo the recognition, Alan, you gave to members of the staff, but I think it's also important to recognize your contributions in this whole process and your leadership, which was absolutely outstanding in every way, in ensuring that we met the goals, the objectives, the mission. So thank you for your leadership.
Larry, that's very kind.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Okay. I think the public session is now closed. Jenny, do you want, and Simon, do you want to close us off? I want to keep everyone on for a very short private session.